Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. And this is Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole, coming at you from the center of the universe. And that is Clear Creek County, Colorado. And excited today in the studio with me is Jerry J.M. Mitchell, who is an award-winning author of three novels, The Height of Secrecy, Public Trust, and Killing Godiva's Horse. In addition to writing novels, his writing has appeared in scientific and conservation journals, travel magazines, and newspapers. He serves on boards of scientific, philanthropic, and writers' organizations and remains engaged with the National Park Services, developing training for natural resource managers. He is the president of the board of directors for the George Wright Society. Jerry had a long career with U.S. National Park Service. He was the chief of the agency's Biological Resource Management Division and retired after 36 years, having worked in Yosemite, Grand Canyon, and Zion National Parks, Washington, D.C., and Fort Collins, Colorado. Over the course of his career, he built park programs and managed park and service-wide resource management activities in a diversity of areas. He has experience in wildlife biology, fire, vegetation, river-regulated river, invasive species and visitor management, and park planning. He serves as the U.S. National Park Service project manager in Phase 2 of the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, the interagency research program focused on the Glen Canyon Dam operations and effects on the Grand Canyon National Park. After the Yosemite flood of 1997, he took a position working for the superintendent, assessing options to achieve the restoration goals of the Yosemite General Management Plan. He was NPS principal in partnering with the University of California, Merced, as they established the Sierra Nevada Research Institute. He was a fellow with the National Park Foundation in Washington, D.C. He received a Master of Science degree in Biology and Bachelor of Science degree in Wildlife Biology, both from the West Texas A&M University. He and his wife split their time between Littleton, Colorado, and their ranch on the Colorado's western slope. JM, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'm excited about this here. You've had quite a career here with the Park Service.
I did. I had a wonderful career.
Why did you get into that? I mean, I assume you did as a young man. What drew you to it?
Well, typical story, I think. I 9 years old or so, we made a trip to Yellowstone as a family, and I saw those men and women in uniform and saw that park, those bears, those elk, those geysers, such beautiful places. Then I had a teacher in middle school who was a ranger at Rocky Mountain National Park. Okay. So we went up one summer and spent a few weeks with him. And that is what I wanted to do in my life.
You got hooked.
I did.
Yeah.
At a very young age.
Wow.
And it was hard to get in those days, and I wasn't sure that I would. I counted myself fortunate when Zion National Park called in the late 70s and mm-hmm. offered me a job, a science job. Mm-hmm. Somehow I miraculously fell into the kind of job that I wanted in a real national park. First job, and had a wonderful career after that.
Wow, and I just love Zion, and it's been mm-hmm. 20 years or more since I've been there, but now I understand, as it is with all of our parks, the overwhelming with people coming in, and now when you go to Zion, for example, you have to, I guess, take a bus, you know, do mm-hmm. the tour, whatever. What are the changes you have seen in your career when you started as this young man and mm-hmm. to this day now when we see the impact on the national parks themselves?
Mm-hmm. At Zion, it's pretty easy to draw the comparisons. When I was there in the late 70s, there was probably a million visitors a year, and now there are many millions a year. And as you say, the bus is the way you get around nowadays. there are lines to contend with that we didn't have lines then. But we had impacts then. The million visitors a year still caused damage, and there are things that we did back then. I had a reading in Springdale a couple of months ago, and so my wife and I went and we looked at some of the things that I had started way back when. Made me feel good to see that many of those things are still there, and some of the things that we anticipated way back in the 80s, if you will, worked. And so the number of people that there, the kinds of impacts that we saw, in some ways the resource is in better condition than it was. In other ways, with the amount of development that's needed to sustain that amount of visitation, there are more impacts in that regard. So that's true of all three parks that I worked in, Grand Canyon, Yosemite. We had to have facilities to manage the number of people that came there. And there are lines, like the line that forms on the freeway on I-70 here, getting to and from the ski areas.
Yeah.
People going into those parks contend with long waits to get in there and queues to get to the things that they want to do. But once they get there and they see El Capitan or Half Dome, the meadows is in Yosemite Valley, they're glad they're there. Yeah. In fact, we have sociological studies that have told us that if they had come years ago when the traffic was less, they're impacted by those crowd levels. If they'd never been there and they come there and they see Half Dome, that meadow for the first time with millions of people around them, they're focused on Half Dome, not the millions of people around them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can appreciate that in a very different context. Many years ago, I went to Greece, and I was so excited to go up onto the Acropolis and see the Parthenon and everything. And again, thousands of people, just about every language in the world, you could hear something, you know. But in a way, it didn't matter. I was there where Socrates was in Plato, and it didn't, you were just there. And so that you kind of like, I don't know, get them out of mind, or they just sort of disappear in a sense.
Yeah. But if you know that quiet or being there all by yourself, it's a little more difficult for
that,
you.
That John Muir moment.
Yeah.
Back there with Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day there. I bet, you know, through your experiences, though, working in the park, the vast majority of people, my philosophy, are good people. But I bet you came across a few characters as well.
I did. And you're right. You know, majority of folks are there for the beauty of the place, the wonder of the place, the wilderness, the wildlife, the experience that they will remember the rest of their lives. And they're wonderful people. And it's pleasant in interacting with people at those moments that they are enjoying so much and will cherish the rest of their lives. But you're right, there are interesting people that will do interesting things. And you remember those too. And in fact, you've touched on something that I thought about when I thought about what I wanted to write about. You know, you think about, I enjoy reading spy novels, but it's not what I know. I know what life in parks is all about. And some of those people, like a few months ago, do you remember seeing on the news a guy in Yellowstone who, I think it was from Colorado, in fact, a guy from Yellowstone that was out of his car taunting a bison.
Yes.
And he would jump out of the way, and the bison would charge, and he'd jump out of the way, and he was taunting him right there with the cameras rolling, and I was watching that on the news, and I was sitting there thinking, get him, get him. Keeping my mouth shut because my wife had a plonker of the Park Service as well. And I was watching her across the room, and she was dodging every time the bison would move. And then I heard her say, get him. But there are people like that out there.
Yeah, and getting too close to the Old Faithful, and you know, it's like, okay, you're gonna fall in, or you want to stand. I don't want it erupts. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know, and but quite a few. Now, what got you into writing then? You know, you have this experience, and you know, you say,
well, I to answer that, I'm gonna bring my mother into the story. to answer that question.
Okay.
As a young guy, I, as I said, I knew I wanted to work for parks, and I knew I wanted to be a biologist. And my mother, who had been an English teacher, English lit major, and a journalist, she would tell me, but you need to learn to write. Mm-hmm. It'll serve you no matter what you do. Learn to write. Mm-hmm. And I discounted that for a number of years until the wisdom of that settled over me. And somewhere in there I started thinking I wanted to write a novel. Mm-hmm. Or novels. And I'll bring my mom back into the story. She too wanted to write a novel. She endeavored to retire, write whodunits in retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And Alzheimer's and cancer got her before she could finish a single novel. And it's a bit of a blessing in disguise, because of the Alzheimer's she didn't understand the cancer, and because of the cancer she didn't endure, you know, the effects of Alzheimer's for a terribly long period of time. But after she died, I told myself, for her and for me, I am going to finish a novel.
Yeah.
And so I started getting up at 5 a.m. and writing for a couple hours before I went to work, to make sure that I finished that novel.
Yeah.
And I did. I ended up getting a big promotion, set aside, took the job in Fort Collins as the chief of the biology division for the agency, and set it aside, knowing that when I retired, I'd pull it out and turn my attention to that again, and that's what I did. But yeah, my mom had some influence on that, yeah.
Wow. And as if, like, she's like a muse for you.
Yeah, she was right too. You know, mm-hmm. you know, scientists, wildlife biologists want to think of themselves as spending their time in the field, and they do, but that work has to be turned into something written.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of technical writing that people in my line of work did.
Mm-hmm.
And you have interests, and I did a lot of writing over the years in popular magazines and mm-hmm. Journals. I've got an article right now in a scientific journal, things like that. She was right. You know, learn to write. It will serve you no matter what you love and want to do. And that was the advice she gave me.
It's you put a face, a human face on humans. Okay, your primary character, Ranger Jack Chastain?
Uh-huh.
Okay. How did you create him? Is he kind of a blend of different characters, or is there one specifically? And notice, you know, you're writing uh-huh. about a ranger at a national park, not an astronaut, for example. So you're yeah. writing about what you know.
Yeah.
So how did Jack come about, and how is he evolving as a complex character?
Mm-hmm. He has evolved in my mind a lot from when I first tried to conceive of him, both in name and who he was and what have you. And the name, that evolved. But by the time, and I had made several starts on the novel and over the years and didn't get finished until that episode I just mentioned. But toward the end of my career, where I had seen more in life than I had at the beginning of my career, I suspect that I thought of a protagonist in very heroic terms.
Right.
And by the end of my career, I was still a pretty idealistic guy, and I saw a protagonist in heroic terms. But heroes get beat up a lot. And so I saw a guy that was damaged, trying to recover from some things that had happened to him in the course of a career.
Mm-hmm.
And those gray areas made for some interesting pathways I could take stories.
Okay. And, you know, it seems because I was an English teacher, and what, and to this day, I still enjoy stories. It doesn't necessarily need a specific plot line or anything, but a character mm-hmm. who has flaws, human flaws, because everybody has them. I just watched, for example, the other night, Good Will Hunting again.
Oh.
Okay. And that young man, and then Robin Williams as his doctor is going to help him, whatever, and his flaws too, and to work through. And so when you have a character like Jack, and he's not a superhero, he's mm-hmm. not this epic hero, he's an ordinary human being who does heroic stuff, but he's also struggling with a whole lot of other stuff. Uh-huh. Maybe it was a divorce, maybe, you know, some other traumatic thing. He has a disability of some sort he has to overcome, and yet still has to do it. I think that really helps the reader then start to identify with that character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. And we all have things that we contend with, you know, mm-hmm. be it making the bills this month, some person that we work with that's a jerk. Mm-hmm. And we survive those things. Yeah. And Jack has to, too. In his story, in his case, he was a loser of a political battle in Montana. And my novels are all set in a fictional national park in New Mexico.
Okay.
And when he first goes to New Mexico, he, because he was a loser in that political battle in Montana, he wants to hide. He does not want to get pulled into anything that could result in something similar happening to him again. And yet, he thinks of himself as not being good enough to be the one dealing with those certain kinds of issues, and yet he is.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he has to deal with the conflict of sorting them out to get through that story. Okay. And yet, at the end of the first story, I realized he's different now. He's just overcome some things that he did not want to face. He had to face them, and he did. How does he change? And so for book two, he changed. Book three, he's changed mm-hmm. in killing Godiva's horse. And I'm right now in the midst of writing the fourth. And that is going to be the most tricky of all, because now he is at a place of great, great anger.
Okay.
And something I personally didn't experience, but I saw other people who did.
Yeah.
I always had an ability to, in the midst of great conflict, bring people together to talk things out. And forget this about me, but Jack, he's coming out of this next episode really angry, goes into the next one really angry. And that comes from, I know that people that, you know, as we sort through things in our life, we go through different stages, we process those things, and it's been fascinating studying people, human nature in that way.
It is. It's a study, and that's what story for me is in large part about, mm-hmm. Jerry, and that is getting into the head and the psyche, the soul of the individuals. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, and I don't know how the story will come, I'll be excited to read it and how it evolves or it comes about, is that with this anger, is it this anger, has it been a result of experiences in a life that has just pushed him to that point? Or is it really tapped into something that he was repressing all along anyway? Mm-hmm. And then you start peeling away all this other stuff. And that's what underneath is this anger that comes maybe from childhood or something, some of this prior experience there that he doesn't even realize is there. And then he starts looking back and saying, like, holy mackerel, where'd this come from, sort of thing there. I don't know. But this is the kind of stuff I think a deep reader, you know, loves to, like, okay, because everybody's does this. Everybody gets angry. That's just part of the human experience here. So that's exciting. How are you doing?
Well, this one, Killing Godiva's Horse starts off with him at a very uncertain place. I won't go in too much, give too much away about it. But you're right. As he processes where he is, at the end of this book, that's where I deliver him. The outcome of the book is good, but that doesn't keep us from carrying some things into the next stages of our life. Mm-hmm. And that's where I deposited him for the next story.
Excellent. Yeah, and that way you could identify with the character and then still continue. So the reader is like, all right, that next novel, all right, I want to see what else happens here.
Yeah.
Because why do certain characters resonate with us more than others?
Yeah.
You know, in any particular story.
And I stories that I enjoy the most are plot-driven stories more than they are character-driven stories. But you can't succeed on a good plot-driven story without characters that make that plot work and whose lives, you know, make some sense.
Right.
To how they respond to what happens in that plot.
Right.
And, I've seen plenty of books out there where they don't put a big investment in the character development of those people in the story, and others whose books are about the characters and the plot just comes along to make something happen here and there.
Yeah.
That's the approach I wanted to take. I wanted a plot-driven story. I wanted a thing to happen, and I also wanted this story of Jack Chastain to matter and for him to evolve.
Yeah.
And where will he be at the end of the series? I'm not sure either.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And how is this coming out of you? And, you know, and the story will unfold, you know.
Well, I had some tough times, but Jack's story is not my story.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to, you know, make that clear, you know, this is not a memoir.
Yeah. and it's a fictional national park in New Mexico.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want people looking at what happened in the story, if I've placed it in Yosemite or Grand Canyon or Zion, and have people look at it and say, is that me? Is that character me? Or is this issue that issue? I didn't want that to happen.
Yeah.
These are all constructs for the enjoyment of writing.
Well, and in psychology, we get into the archetypal characters.
Uh-huh.
And all of us carry different archetypes. I was teacher, for example. You were ranger. Okay. And so why do we identify with certain characters? I mentioned Good Will Hunting before.
Uh-huh.
Well, where is that set? It's set in a college environment, in an educational environment. You have a professor, you have a student and everything. Bingo. That's just automatic for me. I am now hooked into the story.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to maybe a murder mystery that's set in, you know, some town or whatever that I'm not a detective, for example, on a police force. So it might be interesting, but I'm not necessarily going to identify too strongly, perhaps, with that detective. But the teacher in the story, I'm there. And so, and we go, everybody's going now to national park. So I might not be a ranger, but I know rangers, and I know people that are there. You know, so I think, you know, you're on to this in some way. You know, it's interesting right now. And so those, you know, if you're listening to this down the road, and hopefully the national issue will be resolved here. Our national parks are officially closed because of the shutdown.
Yeah.
Okay. Aside from the politics of it there, but in terms of real people, you've been through shutdowns before.
Yeah.
I could imagine you and then the current, you know, on staff rangers are sort of caught in the crossfire.
Yeah.
What was that like? And does that impact your writing in some way?
It absolutely was something I thought about as I thought about what my niche might be in terms of being a writer and how I might tell my stories as a writer. Yeah, I was... Well, let me say this about shutdowns first. There's a law, it's called the Anti-Deficiency Act. It keeps agencies from expending money, obligating funds when there is no appropriation. So that's why parks are shut down when there is no budget, because of that act. And a few years ago when they were shutting the parks down, that was seen as political to some people. And now that this Secretary of Interior, this last one, has kept them open. That's seen as political by other people. You know, there are impacts to doing that, garbage building up, impacts to resources, some deaths occurring without rangers there to respond. So they're going to be criticizing that. And previously, closing them entirely was seen as political, and people were criticized for that. But the people that are, that young ranger that's out there on the trail that responds to some accident, or the ranger that was at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., when that congressman accused him of some sort of game, they're just caught in the middle. They didn't make the decision. The decision was made several layers up. And yet people turn to those folks and say this, say that. But again, they're really just caught in the middle. And that I did think about the government shutdown, because parks become the poster child for the shutdown.
Yeah.
And that I just described, being caught in the middle, that you mentioned there, that is not uncommon. It's not just the shutdown that causes that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I thought that could be one of those things in the fabric of a story that I could use to make the story authentic. And that's one of the things that I try to do, by the way, is mm-hmm. I get reviews that praise that in my stories, is that they are indeed give a sense of authenticity. And I, you know, one of the things that I tried to do in the way I write my stories, instead of telling people, now I'm going to back up just a second. I've had the privilege of this wonderful career working in these places that people love. And it was a wonderful place to work, being in Yosemite or Grand Canyon or Zion.
Oh, yeah.
So people look at that. There are a lot of people that would have wanted that job that I had that didn't have it. And they probably wondered what it would have been like. I have a chance to give them a feeling of what it's like to wear that hat, to be out on that trail, to fight that fire, to conduct that rescue, to make that search. And I learned pretty quick with one of the editors I worked on that telling them about those things wasn't the way to write that story. It would be better to write that story in such a way that those readers are in the shoes of that character.
Yes.
Make things happen. Make them happen the way they really happen. Yeah. And let them be the one who responds to that incident, that fire, that whatever.
Right.
Put them in the shoes, doing the job that they may have always wanted to do.
Yeah, that you, that one, the reader so connects with the character, in this case, maybe a Jack or whoever.
Yeah.
And because, you know, we go to national parks, we see this here, we go wherever. And so we can identify with that experience there. And when the story is well told, it's like you become one with the ranger.
Yeah.
And you're doing this, rescue, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, and this, maybe there's a flash flood coming down, you know, and in New Mexico, your high desert. One of my favorite places is Chaco Canyon National Park there in northwest New Mexico. Well, you know, you get a flash flood in there, and maybe you better be out of the way very quickly, otherwise you're floating down, right?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because in Killing Godiva's Horse, you got two floods, you're going to have to survive. really is, yeah.
Oh, wow.
So you're exactly right.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's what I endeavor to do, is to write it in such a way that they feel that they're in those shoes.
Put that reader right there. Now, you had told me you had a very interesting editor for this last one.
Yeah.
Godiva's Horse?
Yeah.
Her name?
Lynn Stegner, Wallace Stegner's daughter-in-law.
Oh, my God. When you told me that, I went, are you kidding me? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wallace Stegner, one of the greatest writers of the West here. Yeah. Tell more about that. That's fascinating.
The story on it is when people... I had people reviewing Killing Godiva's Horse, I was getting pretty good feedback, good response from folks. There was one scene that two people commented about. And I was talking to my publicist about that. And I also mentioned that I was a little worried that the plot was a little too complicated on this one.
Okay.
And she came back to me and said, well, I know just the person for this kind of book. And she introduced me to Lynn Stegner to see if she would be interested in editing this one. She was very busy, so I had to wait in queue for about 9 months to so she could look at it. But she came back and she said, you know, it is a complicated plot, but it works, so don't mess with the plot. There's a couple places where it moves awfully fast.
Okay.
And we slowed some of those places down.
Okay.
You know, I've always worked to try to speed them up, and she said, you know, she understood what I was trying to do, particularly with as much going on in the book. But we slowed some of them down to give the character and the readers a little breather. And it was, it's always, I love to learn from people like that.
Yeah.
I've got three novels, three different editors I've worked with, and learned something from each of them. So it's always delightful. And I've thought about, when I first started wanting to write a novel, how good would I have been at listening to what was to be learned from an editor when I was 23? Probably not very good.
Right.
but I'm at a point in my life where I cherish that. I enjoyed working with her. It was something. Wallace Stegner, he, you know, environmental historian and novelist, Angle of Repose, Beyond the 100th Meridian, to have that connection to the name. Mm-hmm. Her husband, Stegner's son, Paige, he died this last year. But, you know, if she's available, I'll probably tap into her strengths again.
Yeah, that energy. And then I think also your mother as the English teacher, having been one, and you're still, like, carrying that energy, you're hearing the echoes, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, with that, and you saying not only is she and your other editors helping to perfect a book as best you possibly can. We always go back and say, oh, I wish I would have done this or that or whatever. Okay, get it to the best place it possibly can there. But to learn from them as well.
Yeah.
And that's, as writers, we have to be open to that.
Mm-hmm. And I had on this one, it purposefully gone light on details on characters because I wanted to... It was going to be longer because of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
So I skimped on some details to keep things moving. And that was one of the things that she insisted on the most. You need to help me with a detail or two on this character or that, because I'm mixing them up with this other person. I had a good reason for doing what I'd done, but she understood that.
Mm-hmm.
But she worked with me to get some details back in there.
Yeah.
Where they needed to be.
Yeah.
It was fun, yeah.
And it's amazing how you can tap into your life experiences here. And, you know, you were park ranger or whatever, and, you know, worked in these national parks, and you know, you had in the back of your head here to be a novelist, to at least write one. But able to now bring it forth into a story form. Connected with a character, Jack, in this case here, someone that he is accessible as a reader. I can identify with Jack, perhaps, you know, and start to get that feel, that energy for what it's like to be out in the park. And the next time I go out in the park in real life, I'm really going to be paying attention to those rangers out there and that, and the whole experience of it there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just simply Amazing. Now, you're also on the board for the George Rice Society.
Yeah,
that's new on my radar. What's this about?
It is the professional society for scientists and resource managers who work in parks and protected areas. Most of our members are from North America, United States and Canada, some in Mexico. But we have members from all around the world. Mm-hmm. And George Wright himself was the fellow who convinced the director of the National Park Service way back in the early days of the agency that he needed a scientist. Mm-hmm. And George Wright, even coming from a wealthy family, paid for some of the early studies to get it going. And he created a culture that faded out for a while. Mm-hmm. But then the scientists in the agency created the organization about 40 years ago.
Okay.
And I'm currently the board president, yeah.
Okay. And then in terms of just the general public, mm-hmm. what's its mission to people like me or anyone else? It could be this exclusive area for brainiacs who mm-hmm. know about this and just love to study it there too. But to help educate us, to bring us to a higher level of consciousness in some way?
Well, good question. And I'll answer it like this. The people that you would interact with, that you would go to in a Rocky Mountain National Park, they are dependent on good science and good stories, but good science to understand the ecosystem at Rocky Mountain National Park. And the people that are on staff there to provide that to them, the scientists, the resource managers, they're on staff that work closely with them and working with the public, etc. But also prepare reports or just go sit down with them, have coffee and explain something. We are their professional network. We help them understand what they need as scientists to remain current in their science and scholarship.
Okay.
And we do that through a journal, the George Wright Society Forum. We do that through conferences and things like that. So we help them remain current, give them a network, help them aspire to be as good as they can be and give them the tools to do that. And the visitor, when they come to the park, they undoubtedly benefit through the things that come organically up through the whole organization to make them stronger because of the work that happens from the people on staff there.
Okay. And
I apologize about that long-winded
answer. No, it's excellent. Not at all. I'm glad because it helps me then appreciate one of my life philosophies is that people could be divided in a sense into two groups.
Mm-hmm.
Those who just want to be informed, you get revealed new information, you go out there and you stand there agape and look at Old Faithful or something of this nature. But then there's also the discoverers.
Mm-hmm.
And discovery to me is an eternal process. You can never learn everything there. And so John Muir, 100 years, 150 years, well, not quite 150, but the late 19th century, early 20th century, the great conservationist and the discovery of the world out there, and we start to learn more. And then what you have done, what seems to be happening then, and then the new young people coming in, building on that, but then I come as a visitor. I just don't want to walk around and say, wow, and take a picture with a camera. I want to learn more. I want to dig deeper, too, and discover.
Yeah, and when you ask that hard question, and that naturalist or that young ranger doesn't know the answer,
mm-hmm.
and there's a good chance that they will, but if they don't know the answer, they want to turn to a network of people to help them to dig into that and know that they can answer the question.
Right.
Maybe even get back to you,
yeah,
or answer the next people that ask that question better.
Yeah, Yeah, because that's, and I'll go back to my experience in Greece, that because I studied Greek mythology and culture and history way back when, and when I went over, I could not talk to the tour guides enough. And then what I found out, that you just don't get hired to be, you know, maybe out at Delos or Apollo with the Delphi there, that it takes rigorous training. And these people know, and you have to pass tests, and you have to be certified, you know, to get there. So you just can't show up and say, yeah, I read a book on whatever there. And it's a continual learning process. Yeah. It's something that's amazing.
And I suspect if you went up to Rocky Mountain National Park at the beginning of the season, they would probably have, training for their people who have the most contact with the public, and they bring in the scientists and other people every year to talk about what they've been doing lately and what they've learned, and that becomes something that arms them to do a better job as they interact with the public.
Yeah. And your works then, I want to just loop back to them, I think contribute to that as well.
To my work?
Yeah. Your novels.
My novels?
Yeah. That create a curiosity within the reader.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so. For each book, I've chosen a little topic that I use to, you know, weave through the story, give it some importance, give the topic, give the issue some importance. In this one, it's rhino poaching in Kenya. And maybe I should give a quick summary of what killing Godiva's horse is.
Killing, okay, this is killing
Godiva. Killing Godiva's horse.
Okay, yeah. So just a little background, whet the appetite with not too much spoiler alert, right?
Yeah, I won't give too much away. Okay. But the book starts with Jack being pulled into a battle with a man who wants to start a Western Lands Rebellion. The cameras are rolling. Okay. The nation sees it. And the director of the agency, to hide him away for a while, sends him to Kenya to finish the research of a young Kenyan scientist killed by a rhino poacher. And while he's there, he sees the risks that they take, those young rangers over there, the risks they take, they see the reasons people are putting at risk these rhinoceros, which are part of the heritage of that nation. One night, he comes across a group of poachers sitting around a campfire, and he overhears one of the poachers, in a heavy accent, say something that sounds like a connection to the scientist that was killed, the rhino that was killed, the horn that was taken. There's a connection to a man, to someone in New Mexico. Did I hear that right? New Mexico? Why? What? Why? So that mystery carries into the rest of the story.
Okay.
And it's an interesting story because those people over there, I use that one because those rangers over there really are facing tremendous risks. A lot of rangers killed over there protecting the things that they value. Well, the issues are not all that different here in the United States. We have things that crop up, and we have things that we value that could be lost. We have people dedicated to protecting them that put their lives on the line. So it gave me a good opportunity to tell that kind of story. Yeah. And at the same time, weave some science in there to give the character some credibility as someone that knew how to do that work.
And you also universalized the story. Rangers are just not endemic to the United States. Right. You closely identify with the ones in Kenya doing the same things, okay? Experiences the same risks, you know, there. And that's magnificent in that regard. Uh-huh. You know, so that's exciting to hear on that. So congratulations on that there.
It was fun. Yeah. I was a little self-conscious about talking about somebody else's culture. And I, one of our members of the George Wright Society, I was talking to a guy at a, during a break at a conference, and a young PhD student from Kenya willingly read through Killing Godiva's Horse before I
put it. Oh, wow.
So,
yeah, that's awesome. Okay, yeah. We only have a couple minutes left here. So people want to learn more about you, your work, your website.
What is it? jmmitchellauthor.com?
Mm-hmm.
jmmitchellauthor.com.
Okay.
And if you're interested in picking up Killing Godiva's Horse, right now it's on the racks at Tattered Cover. All three stores, I believe. There's Barnes & Noble over on Colorado that has it on the shelves. And all the usual suspects, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, etc.
Exactly. Oh, that's awesome. And the George Wright Society?
Yeah, you can find the George Wright Society at georgewrightsociety.org.
Okay.
Again, we're a scientific society. Our mission, some examples of our work, or the work of our members, you can find on our website there too.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, JM. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Very, very illuminating. Obviously, I'm an outdoors type of person, been to many of the national parks and just that whole experience, but just to, again, connect with men, women, just like you, who go out there and experience this all the time. What is it like to be in that role? You know, in so many ways, we have it on this idealistic plane and it's all this wonderful stuff there. But it's also some very challenging situations.
Yeah.
You know, characters that come in there as well. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I hope I have captured that in my novels in such a way that people would both enjoy the adventure and the story.
And when's the next novel due?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
It's in the process right
now.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Well, you whetted our appetite.
It could be a year. It could be.
All right.
I'm in no rush to, if it needs someone like an editor to spend some good time with it, we'll do that.
Sounds good. Yeah. All right. Okay, everyone. Hey, this is Jerry Fabiana, KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9. This has been Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole. Visiting here with J.M. Mitchell and all about his works, and his experiences in the national parks. And hopefully you will find this intriguing and be out there looking for his book. So again, go to jmmitchellauthor.com for his work, and we'll be back. Bye now.